to our teleconference this afternoon. We've got a great panel of speakers. This is Scott Becker, and I'll briefly introduce the speakers and the agenda, and then we'll let our speakers take it from there. First, we've got David Fleisch, who's a consultant at Bain Consulting, one of the leading consulting companies in the world, who will be speaking about developing strategy for hospitals and for surgery centers and giving an overview of how to approach strategy. Second and third, from Surgical Care Affiliates, we've got the president and CEO, Andrew Hayek, an extremely smart person who's been running Surgical Care Affiliates for the last year or so and has done a tremendous job of building that company and growing it again. And he'll be talking more focused on surgical hospital approaches, not surgical hospitals, surgery centers and hospital partnerships, and how to look at things from a synergistic perspective between hospitals and surgery centers. David Whalen will be joining Andrew Hayek, also from Surgical Care Affiliates, and he's the Senior Vice President at SCA. Finally, speaking more specifically on surgical centers and the trends and strategies and thoughts facing surgery centers, we've got two of the brightest minds in the surgery center business. First, Dr. Brent Lambert, a founder and president of Ambulatory Surgical Centers of America. And he's joined by Luke Lambert, who for a long time now has been the chief executive officer of Ambulatory Surgical Centers of America. So with that, each speaker will talk for 10 to 20 minutes. We'll also have the ability for question and answer. There's an ability on your screen to type in a question that you have, and we'll try and make sure throughout the webinar that as many questions as possible are also addressed. With that, let me turn it over to David Fleisch of Bain. David?
Thank you, Scott. If we could tee up the next slide. Thank you. With Andrew and Brent and their colleagues on, Scott asked me to gear my comments towards hospitals today. I think a lot of what I say will be very applicable to surgery centers as well. Just to give you a little bit of a background on Bain, we've been around for 40 years. We do a lot of provider work, but we're not a hospital consulting firm only. We're not a healthcare consulting firm only. And as a result, we end up bringing insights from a lot of other industries. We have a real focus on helping companies find where they make their money, how to make more of it faster, and how to sustain their growth longer. And what I'm going to talk about today is work that we've developed over the last 40 years, both from in the field work with our clients, as well as from research that we've done along the way. Next slide. Could I get the next slide? Thank you. The hospital business is changing quite significantly, and with the enactment of healthcare reform and an increasing move over time to things like bundled payments and accountable care organizations, we're going to find that a lot of the ways and the strategies in which hospitals made money in the past are going to change. In many cases, what had been sources of profit, like in-hospital GI, are now going to be viewed as high-cost locations, that even those accountable care organizations are going to be looking to move volume. The way in which hospitals compete is going to be different, and some assets that previously had not been at the forefront of competition, like their IT systems, their ability to mine data on clinical outcomes, on patient referral flow, will become much more important. As well as physician relationships, the ability to have collaborative group of physicians who falls behind care protocols is going to be much more important than it's been in the past. And so as you think about the changes in the boundaries of the hospital business and think about, do we need to be expanding deeper into the continuum of care, should we be buying, should we be partnering, it really raises strategy to a new level again for hospitals. Next. Next slide. Thank you. When it comes down to it, I think a question that's really easy to ask is, well, isn't strategy just about getting more cases and getting more doctors? And I think the challenge is that as any provider knows, You're getting pulled in an enormous number of directions, whether it is reinvesting in your existing service lines, trying to figure out whether or not you should enter new service lines and how you get them to scale, thinking about what your strategy is for the integration of low-cost sites and other areas of post-acute care. How do you balance physician loyalty, physician employment, differentiated outcomes? There are a lot of things being pulled on any given hospital, and it's really about where strategy is really about where do you invest when you're being pulled in a lot of different directions. Next slide. We have done a rolling study for the last 18 years. We've been looking at 10-year increments of what it takes for companies to sustainably grow year after year and drive creation of value. What we found is if you look at the 100% of the companies that we've studied, only a quarter of them have been able to sustainably grow sales at 5.5% real. So sales growth in itself in a sustainable way year in, year out on its own is hard. If you then layer on making sure that growth is profitable, you cut the sample down to 1 in 6. And then if you layer on, do that in a capital efficient way, the odds of sustainable profitable growth are really about 1 in 8. And so looking at those companies and seeing what have they consistently done to grow profitably leads to some pretty interesting insights. If you go to the next slide, what you'll see is that those sustained value creators, as we call them, follow a pretty predictable cycle of first focusing on building a very strong core. First and foremost, you need to know where you're making your money, when you have the choice of investing in your core business or in things that are on the periphery, the investment in the core almost always wins in terms of your likelihood of successfully driving profitable outcomes. When you move when you have a core then that is at its full potential and you start to think about how do you grow that core, what we have found over time is that doing expansion in a repeatable way, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, is the path to success. And then lastly, as the industry starts to hit turbulence, and you need to start to think about redefining your basis of competition, looking for those hidden assets in your business that are things that your business does but hasn't been nearly as central to your way of competing, as the industry is changing, those assets start to become much more important. We're going to talk now, next slide, about this issue of focus. And I'll ask you to maybe go on one more slide to slide 8. It goes without saying that the leaders in any given industry, next slide please, the leaders in any given industry are returning much higher returns on their in their business than followers. Having a strong core business matters a lot. I'll give you a specific example in hospitals if you turn to the next slide. In the area of cardiovascular surgery, next slide please, thank you. In the area of cardiovascular surgery, historically, I think we're one too far, should be on 10, thank you. In the area of cardiovascular surgery, if you look across, take any given geography, Chicago is one example. What we show here are all of the hospitals in Chicago and their cardiovascular volumes. Typically, there are a few very large ones, but a lot of folks who are in the game, but it's not a real part of their core business. In a number of markets, both regulators and payers have now started to say, you know what, we're not going to. There are real learning curves on both quality and cost, and we are not going to keep each of these sites open and approved for CV surgery. And you've seen in Michigan, you've seen in Florida movements to defining a minimum level threshold of about 300 surgeries. All of those other hospitals to the right of that line are now starting to, if that were coming into place in Chicago, would now need to start to think about. Is CV surgery really a core to my business? Do I need to rebuild around that core? Am I going to bring in expensive surgeons? Can I get the volumes? Should I be partnering for CV surgery? And so really understanding where your core is and understanding whether you make money will cause you to say, yes, I'm going to go down that path, or no, I'm not. Next slide. That's just one of the eight things that we showed earlier, which is reinvestment in leading service lines. Is this at my core? Next slide. Next slide, please. We seem to be having a little bit of trouble. If you start to think about those other seven poles, you need to start to believe that you have a clear path as to deciding which adjacencies to pursue. Because if you try to pursue everything, you're going to fail. And I'll start to then move from focus into expand on slide 13. Next slide, please. The companies that have fully exploited their core business are now in a strategic position to be able to grow into new markets. What we found is oftentimes this is where companies go wrong. They start to look for expansions that are far beyond their core and create a lot of organizational confusion. What we found is smaller moves that are close to your core that reinforce that core business, and particularly ones that are repeatable, and I'll talk about repeatability in a minute, are the real path to success. And for this example, I want to actually talk a little bit about, move out of healthcare for a moment and talk a little bit about the fortunes of Nike and Reebok. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. In the late 80s, early 90s, there was really Nike and Reebok were at very much the same place in the athletic shoe industry. If you looked at almost any account, people were viewing this as a neck and neck race of two equally matched competitors. And I think what you'll find as we go through the next few slides is that the strategic choices that they made, Nike focusing very much on repeatability, Reebok really following fad of the year, led them to very, very different places. Next slide. Can we go to slide 15, please? We lay out on the next slide when it shows up all of the potential paths that Nike could have taken. And what Nike started to do was to choose a sport, find an iconic figure around which to build a portfolio, eventually expanded to apparel, eventually expanded to equipment. Did they start down that path of saying, we're going to make basketballs at the time that they signed Michael Jordan? No, they didn't. But they found that it was a model around which they could build a very attractive franchise. And as you'll see, if we could just very quickly click through the next few slides without the voiceover, they proceeded to do this in sport after sport. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see they followed the success in basketball, in tennis with John McEnroe. Next slide. They followed it into soccer with the Brazilian soccer team. And then eventually, next slide, they followed it into golf. And even Nike eventually choice of their cover boy was not necessarily terrific long term, but the franchise around Tiger Woods was very successful for a long period of time, and you really saw that relentless repeatability. If you go to that next slide, if you flip to the path that Reebok took, it was very, very different. Reebok was all over the place. They started down the path of shoes, various sports, then went on to other shoe types. They eventually went on and bought Boston Whalers, a boat business. They went back to tennis to try to regain the core, back to tennis and basketball to try to regain the core, ultimately getting into golf clothes. But it was a very, very haphazard way of looking at adjacencies. And if you look at Reebok, next slide, please, they ended up selling off the vast majority of those adjacent moves over time. It was a process and a strategy that was pretty deeply flawed. If you go to the next slide, we're now on to slide 22. The results, one more please, the results between Nike and Reebok are tremendously different, and a lot of that really is anchored back into this repeatability. If you think about why repeatability matters, and I'll probably close up with two more slides. If you go to slide 22, why repeatability matters, it's really about building the organization for a focused purpose. Your ability to make decisions faster and more reliably, get down a learning curve, and really begin to think several moves ahead. Next slide. And now one more onto slide 24, and I'll wrap up my thoughts here. As providers think about harnessing the power of repeatability, I'd ask you to think about where does repeatability matter for you as you think about growing out subscale service lines or entering new service lines. If that's the path that you want to take, what is the repeatable model you can use in order to drill success into those programs? Similarly, about expanding share geographically. And then as the environment is changing, as the business is changing, thinking about developing repeatable models for superior outcomes. How do you start with one group of procedures and move to the next and really show differentiated clinical outcomes that will both draw patients as well as improve payer contracting? I've got a little bit more, but I will I'll hand the microphone over to Andrew Hayek right now, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks all for joining today. It's great to be on the call here with Scott, you, and Brent, and Luke. It's a privilege to join you. I'll be relatively brief, and I'm joined today by Dave Whalen, and Dave is a VP of Development who has experience on the hospital system side doing ASC joint ventures. He was at Memorial Hermann, where he was the chief strategy officer and did more than a dozen surgery centers. So if we go to the next slide, terrific. The landscape is changing in the ASC industry. And as you can see, between 2006 and 2008, the portion of centers that are partnered, either with a hospital or a corporate partner or both, has increased substantially from 25 to 37% of the market. If we had data for 2010, I'm confident it would be in the low 40s. So what we see is a migration from standalone facilities to partnered. And there are various reasons for this. From a physician standpoint, there is the waning out-of-network model, more and more pressure on out-of-network, reimbursement pressure. Expenses continue to rise, especially around surgical implants. This creates margin pressures and therefore a need to create value. So the goals for affiliating either with a corporate partner or a health system or both are to access capital, have a stable long-term partner to return to growth, both top line and margin growth, gain some contracting leverage, gain the economies of scale that come with a large corporate partner. So, for example, our company aggregates about $200 million in supply spending, which creates a lot of purchasing power, generally between 20 and 30% savings versus what a standalone center would get. So accessing that kind of economy of scale, and then getting a partial liquidity event. In our case, if the physician partners so choose, we can start with a minority investment, let's say a 20% investment in the center, and then agree that 4 or 5 years out we would purchase up to a 51% ownership, or we can remain in that minority position. So we're very flexible around creating various types of liquidity. So with that, let me turn it to Dave Whalen, who will walk through the next two slides about the health system perspective.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. Given changing physician attitudes towards partnering with either a corporate management development partner or a health system partner more significantly, we think that health systems have a unique opportunity right now to take advantage of this changing landscape. We think overall there's an opportunity inside of your communities to build a leading network of ASCs, pursue more than one transaction to try to really build a real network, a real brand presence in the ambulatory surgery space. Obviously, if one pursues that kind of strategy in a particular health systems marketplace, there are a series of byproducts that result. You can go out and recapture some of the volumes that have been lost over the last half a dozen years to freestanding physician-owned centers, and for a change, you can go out and make acquisitions that represent truly incremental business and grow your surgery volume base. Obviously, an ASC strategy, the pursuit of an ASC strategy allows you to gain access to what physicians and patients are increasingly demanding, which are freestanding, efficient, convenient, high-quality facilities that don't involve a prototypical hospital experience. It can free up capacity in your existing ORs. Probably more than anything, it's an opportunity to align with high-quality physicians, many of whom in today's practice patterns are not busy on the inpatient side. Many of our best and most productive partners are very high-quality, very well-trained physicians, but whose practices are virtually 100% outpatient, and a strategy like this affords an opportunity to connect with them in a very material way. And you can see we've got some other potential benefits listed there, including expanding the health system's name, reputation, and physical market presence in a relatively capital-light manner. The investments in an ASC network relative to some of your other service line investment opportunities is relatively small. If we could flip the page. Thank you. So what we tried to list on this page were if a health system is to embark on a strategy as described on the prior page, what are the factors that are going to be determinant in your success? First and foremost, we believe that these kinds of relationships and these kinds of strategies work best when there really is a overarching theme or strategy and goal in mind. We don't think reacting to a physician who says they're going to sell a portion of their surgery center to your competitor constitutes a strategy. These sorts of enterprises work best when you have taken a overall look at the marketplace. You know what the supply of surgery centers is in your marketplace. You know the physicians who are engaged in those centers, either as owners or utilizers, and you have a plan for reaching out to them, introducing the health system as and the management partner as partners in that venture. You have a value proposition that the physicians will react favorably to, and you have a sense of what your capacity is for taking on these transactions on an annual basis and over an extended period of time. So having that destination in mind is the single most important factor, and we very typically work with health systems to fashion that strategy before we go public, so to speak, with opportunities to specific doctors. It's highly related to the second point of knowing what you're going after. A lot of that has to do with just understanding the current business situation at these individual physician-owned centers. Are they growing? Are they out of network or in network? Is there a supply of physicians to replace perhaps some of the maturing older docs who may be looking to cash out? So you really need to understand what you're targeting to be able to put an appropriate value on those and understand those centers' attractiveness. The third factor I'd highlight is physician ownership and commitment. We believe as a company, and I think it's common across the industry, that these centers work best when the doctors are truly vested in the center. And I use the term vested broadly, but included in that is a financial ownership. And we find actually that 40% or greater physician ownership is typically the sweet spot where physicians are really engaged in the future of the center, the quality of the center, the services being levels being provided to the patients, when their ownership level is of a significant magnitude, like 40% collectively, then you're hitting that zone where you really can have a responsive physician group. I've told stories where I've been involved in surgery centers that have hospital ownership. And a hospital CEO who has discussions with his or her doctors about supply standardization in the hospital, as you know, can be a very, very challenging task. that same CEO can cross a parking lot to a joint-ventured surgery center, and with those very same doctors have a very, very different kind of conversation because they are vested in the outcomes in the center and understand a little bit more materially and immediately the impact of some of those supply purchasing decisions. So allowing for a significant amount of physician ownership helps promote some of that involvement and engagement. Number four, contracting on behalf of the physician network, it is essential. We look to structure the ownership in these ventures such that the health system can contract on behalf of the center. We do find that there is often a material revenue enhancement opportunity embedded in that relationship. And so if you are a passive investor, passive minority investor in your ventures, you might want to look at some restructuring opportunities to position yourself so that you can contract for the centers. I won't read each and every one of these. I'll highlight just a few of the rest. We do believe that health systems can gain a sufficient level of ownership and control without owning an absolute 51% ownership structure. It typically involves the formation of a parent JV with your management partner and having that parent JV own or control approximately 51%. And obviously, yes, we'd be happy to help you walk through those steps. You do want to seek a partner who is well capitalized and in this business for the long term, and I'm speaking to a management partner. Obviously, health system partners are typically have been operating in their marketplace for decades, if not more. Upwards of 100 years is not uncommon, and you're not looking to have a management partner who isn't going to be in the business in 2 or 3 years. So you want to look for a long-term partner. You obviously want to negotiate non-competes and buyback provisions so that the health system can control some of those long-term outcomes of what happens to the center as relationships do change over the very long term. And we do think that this strategy, a joint venture strategy, can complement other physician integration strategies, inclusive of physician employment. We have worked with systems that employ specialists and allow them to invest in surgery centers. We have also worked with systems where the physician entity is the joint venture partner. So we think that if you can take a creative and flexible approach to physician integration, we can find more than one way to engage the doctors in the ventures. And with that, I think I'm going to hand it back to Andrew.
Thanks, Dave. And on the SCA team, Dave, for example, focuses on working with health systems and physician partners simultaneously to craft these types of deals, having done more than a dozen of these in his life in the Houston market with Memorial Hermann. So if you flip, we're on now the next page in the changing landscape of the ASC industry. I'm now at my 2-year mark in the industry, just almost exactly 2 years since joining SCA. My history is in diagnostic imaging, radiation therapy, dialysis, and home health, and I've seen the same sort of transition occur in these other industries. And what I'd like to paint is a bit about how the industry is shifting. In the past, there's been a little bit more of what I'd call the flip this house strategy, which is essentially buy low or invest low and then sell at an inflated price to a larger ASC company. Some of the values, purchase values I've seen in the late 90s and early part of this decade are truly remarkable. Those days are over. The larger players now are more price disciplined. And so that notion of just get in low, flip it high by pulling a couple levers, that is more or less past. Second is this build it and they will come. I think that Brent will echo this. Certainly we see the pace of new builds in the industry slowing, and the industry is maturing. Most markets are fairly well served now that there are 5,200 ASCs across the country. Third, out-of-network as a permanent strategy is waning. Out-of-network can be a good lever to reset rates in a center where the contracts are poor, but it is more of a temporary strategy rather than a permanent strategy. And then lastly, we've seen some of the habits in the past that inhibited larger companies from things like minority investments also passing. This whole notion that the larger companies must have 51% or some sort of control provision is also passed, and I'm speaking for ourselves and certainly USPI in a similar spot in making minority investments, and I know Brent does the same. So if I think about today and then into the future, Larger companies are open to a full range of deal structures, including minority investments. That's something we do and others do, especially in the context of a three-way deal with a health system and physician partners. We would almost always be in a minority position as a management company in that kind of structure. Second, we find sellers looking for a long-term operating partner, someone who is going to be here 10, 20 years into the future and can bring sustained value. They want to know who their partner is today and who their partner will be 5, 10, 15 years from now. Third, economies of scale are more important than ever. As there's reimbursement and cost pressure, areas like supply chain, again, where we aggregate about $200 million in spend, we actually run our own GPO where we can get better pricing than external GPOs, allows us to save between 20 and 30%. And we've seen this as we've brought in individual centers and even networks of centers. And then that last point is the consolidation that's been underway for the last 4, 5, 6 years is continuing and will accelerate. This is part of a maturing business and a natural part of the cycle of the industry. Let's flip slides. So quick note on FCA, we've got 126 facilities, most of them surgery centers, some of them surgical hospitals. We have worked with a number of companies in the industry to create transparent clinical quality outcomes reporting, and our results are very strong clinically. You can see the teammate and physician count, about $700 million in revenue, and then a strong balance sheet. So we've got access to capital and a private equity partner who has interest in investing more capital. And this is more important to the health system partners often than it is to an individual center. Often you can find a buyer for an individual center. But when you're thinking about a broad strategy with a health system and how an individual center might fit into that broad strategy, having access to capital is important to hospitals and health systems when really thinking through launching an ASC strategy, because although some systems do still have capital, they often have many competing priorities for that capital, infrastructure, retrofits, et cetera. And the last point I'd make about us is, as we're in the acquisition mode, which we are, we're both acquiring existing centers, we're building new centers, and then we're doing a combination of both of them in partnerships with hospitals. Let's flip slides. Our operating model is relatively straightforward. We focus first and foremost around clinical quality and patient safety. That's our number one priority, and that's at the top of all of our operating metrics. Second, we pay close attention to how we serve our physicians. They are our customers. There's just no two ways about it. Everyone in our organization is focused on serving physicians and creating measurable value. We have a huge focus on recruiting outstanding talent, both in our home office and our field leaders, and how we develop them. Actually, just last week, we wrapped up 3 more days of training and development for our leaders. We had 200-plus people together. We make a significant multi-million-dollar investment in developing outstanding leaders. We have a very data-driven process and disciplined way of pulling through results. It's tailored to each center. Every center is unique and different. And when we identify the 2 or 3 important opportunities at that center, we bring in all the appropriate resources and people and best practices to help that center realize the opportunity, be it in managed care or supply chain or labor efficiency or wherever that opportunity is. We work a lot on realizing the economies of our scale, and we spend a lot of time sharing the best practices. As we poll our physicians, which we do very regularly and consistently, they've told us 8 things that we do that create value, and it's echoed by our health system partners. First is clinical excellence. All of you know that the survey process is becoming much more intense. The conditions for coverage obviously have expanded enormously. We're finding the frequency and the rigor of the surveys being much higher this year than they have been in prior years. And so we have a lot of tools and support resources for our centers as they go through that survey process. And we're very active in advocacy, as is Brent. So I have the privilege of working with him and other companies in really representing our industry. We do a lot around supply savings, and so, we run our own GPO. We aggregate more than $200 million in spending and get to 20 to 30% savings. We are very disciplined around how we reach out in the communities that our centers are in, map all the physicians, reach out to them and market to them in a structured way, bring in experts for areas like spine, where we have somebody who will fly into the market, run seminars and training, again, targeted around specialties that we think there's a lot of opportunity in. So we do a lot to support volume growth. We're sophisticated and aggressive as it relates to payer contracting. I think this is something Brent will echo, but what you must simply be very, very aggressive because obviously the payers are being aggressive with surgery centers, and so we are aggressive back. Do a lot of benchmarking, a lot of training, and then we have a focus on labor efficiency and the tools and data to support it. The next slide is a brief snapshot of our own results. We were separated out of HealthSouth in 2007, at which time we put all these practices into place, and you can see the impact on the profitability of our centers. This picture is the snapshot of our distributions across all of our centers added together, and it's a short way of saying the tools that we've developed, the best practices we've implemented, do work, and we're seeing them work in a powerful way on the centers that we work with currently. Next slide is a list of our health system partnerships. So this list is actually only partial because we just signed agreements with Hawaii Pacific, a large health system in the Hawaii Islands, and with WakeMed, a large health system in North Carolina. So this list is growing, but it speaks to we've got the experience of putting together three-way ventures between health systems, physicians, and then a management company. The last slide is that I'll share is our perspective on the market and on ourselves. I'll start with we really have three focus areas. First is outstanding patient care, patient safety, clinical outcomes. Second is creating measurable value for our doctors. And third is recruiting and developing outstanding leaders who can help our administrators realize targeted value, identify it, and go get that value created. We are actively acquiring centers. We're at a pace of about adding a center every other month, and that'll ramp up to adding a center about every month by the end of this year. We have a private equity partner with a great interest in investing more capital. We make both majority and minority investments. We're flexible. And our deal structures include physician and SCA as well as physician hospitals and SCA. We do both, and we're seeing about 50-50 in terms of our mix when we add new centers of being physician only and then having a health system partner as well. And then we're open to out-of-network centers. The pricing needs to reflect the risk in that out-of-network contracting piece, but of course we don't shy away from taking a very hard and serious look at out-of-network centers. Last couple points, we are built to last. We're positioning our company to be here 10, 20, 30 years from now as a stable long-term partner to physicians and to health systems. And lastly, we take our role in the industry, as I know Brent does and Luke do, with as a corporate citizen. So we do a lot for our teammates and the communities that we serve. We also do our share for the industry and representing us on Capitol Hill, and I think we've made some real progress over the last year in doing some new things on behalf of our whole industry. So appreciate your attention today, and it's with pleasure. I'll turn it over to Brent.
Thank you, Andrew. Could I have the next slide, please? For our part on this webinar, I'm going to spend just a few minutes describing the landscape as we see it for ASCs. And then Luke is going to talk about strategies to deal with that landscape that we're encountering. Andrew alluded to it, but we're seeing dramatic change in the ASC industry in terms of growth. We're seeing the ASC no longer growing. I've been in this industry 26 years, and this is the slowest growth we've ever seen. Last year was the slowest growth in 25 years. And what I think we're going to see this year is that we're going to have as many closing ASCs as openings, and I think maybe even more. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, for the first time in our industry, a decline in the number of ASCs. And the reason for that is that as Luke will explain a little later, is that these ASCs are getting squeezed in these financial times. Many of the ASCs, 50%, were either losing money or breaking even. And the doctors who were feeding these and covering the shortfall are no longer able to do so, and many of them are giving up. Next slide. The pool of surgeons is not growing, but rather contracting as a function of the population. And with the new Health Reform Act, we're going to be seeing 30 million new patients, and the surgical professional coverage is just not there to accommodate them. And so within the ASC industry, for reasons that have already been alluded to, we're seeing a decline in the number of available surgeons to recruit. it's not uncommon for us to go into a town trying to acquire a new surgical center or an existing surgical center and find that there are no surgeons to recruit. They're either working for the hospital or they're already in an ASC, and they have a covenant not to compete, and so they can't join us. And so there's no one to recruit and help, and hence no cases to recruit for the center that we're trying to acquire. Next line. What we're seeing across the board, almost virtually in every state that we operate in, is a maturation of ASCs where there are inadequate or no evergreen provisions in the documents. So we encounter ASCs that have been in existence 15 to 20 years. The original investors, the original surgeons that that developed the ASC and prospered have now retired, and they're in Florida, but still drawing revenues from the centers. This is very discouraging to the surgeons that are continuing to operate there, and it makes it very, very difficult to recruit for these centers. So, for those ASCs out there, I would make sure that there are provisions within the documents to retire from the partnership those surgeons that have retired and are no longer bringing patients to the center. Pay them a fair market value and recycle those shares to new surgeons that are coming into the community. I would say that this is one of the chief problems besetting ASCs currently. We're trying to buy a center in the South that has a number of physicians that have retired, and they have in their documents that they can continue to draw distributions for the next 10 years after they retire. That doesn't work. So we've had to modify those documents appreciably in order to make it so that we can recruit new doctors. So this is a significant problem. Next slide. Andrew's already alluded to consolidation of payers, and with the Health Reform Act, we're seeing we're going to see a massive growth in government covered lives, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it more than double over the next 10 years. So we're going to have a government payer that is not attuned to our concerns, in the sense that they don't factor in a profit margin into their analytics. They also don't calculate the cost of capital into their formulas for reimbursement. And as we all know, they're virtually impossible to negotiate with. So just in terms of the government payers, we've got a problem. And we're seeing among the commercial payers a dramatic consolidation over the last few years. Next slide. Andrew has already spoken about it, but the elimination of out-of-network is rapidly upon us. We're seeing it virtually in every market. The last bastion of out-of-network practice is New Jersey, and that's quickly going by the wayside. In our ASC facility there, we're rapidly using the out-of-network while it still exists to negotiate better contracts. And we've already accepted the reality that we're all going to be in network shortly. So this is something that is upon us. We're trying to acquire a center in the West, and we realized after some analysis that all of their profits came from out-of-network, which were dwindling quickly. Their in-networks were strictly break-even, so it lowers the value of the center. Next slide. The private equity fervor, as I would characterize it for the ASC industry, is declining in some areas. Now, Andrew just described his situation as in which his private equity backer is avid for investment. But in other instances around the industry, we're seeing a waning of that interest. Some established companies having a hard time recapitalizing. Other private equity firms are wanting to bail out and seeking less in terms of return than they had originally planned. So this is a real factor. Next slide. Everybody has spoken about this so far, and I just, without being redundant, I just want to echo it once more, is that the minority model is gaining acceptance with private equity investors and the public market. And when I entered this industry 26 years ago, the minority model didn't exist. You either had 51% or you, you know, if you were a public company or a would-be public company, and it was as simple as that. And it's what's happened is that the minority model has been shown to work well. And next slide. And the last point I'd like to make is that the ASC industry has and still is weak politically vis-a-vis the hospital industry. But this is changing rapidly with the ASC Association Advocacy Committee, comprised of corporate industry leaders. Andrew Hayek has been the leader in this, and we wouldn't be where we are today without him. And the ASC industry and the ASC Association joining with corporate industry in this advocacy committee, and it's very exciting what is underway. And for the first time in our industry, we will speak as one voice to Congress and to the regulators, and we will be effective. And so I would like to turn the time over to Luke now, and he can talk about some specific strategies.
Good to be with all of you today. Over the past 10 years, we've seen some steady trends that by this point have really begun to put the pinch on surgery centers around the country. And really what this means is that surgery centers, while facing increasing costs, increasing labor costs, supply costs, malpractice costs, and other costs, at the same time, their reimbursements in virtually all markets have either been steady or declining. So as your revenue is holding constant or declining and your costs are increasing, this is putting a squeeze on the surgery centers, lowering margins across the industry. And as a result, as Brent and others have mentioned, there are significant numbers of surgery centers that are no longer as profitable as they once were or are never attaining significant profitability. As also I'd like to mention, as described by Andrew, really they're having a minority-driven option or model will be of a huge benefit to corporate entities within the surgery center industry. And if we could move to the next slide. In the past, we've seen a lot of companies that have taken an approach which I would describe as really being capital-driven growth. They marched around with a large checkbook and bought successful surgery centers around the country. And while there have been many of us that have benefited from that strategy as we sold successful surgery centers to these companies, I do not think that they have realized the types of returns that they had hoped for. And my conclusion of watching this over the past decade is that really capital is very much more abundant than is good management. And the companies that ignore the virtues of the minority model, whereby the physicians control a majority interest and continue to have, on paper, control of the center, those companies that ignore that are going to be struggling. They're really operating with one arm tied behind their back. As Andrew has mentioned, there are ways to exert sufficient control in a center for a company to operate well and profitably while harnessing all the positive aspects of deep physician commitment and involvement. When it comes down to raising capital, entities that are good operators do not really have much in the way of needs. First off, their own returns in their investments are sufficiently strong that they generate their own capital for future growth. Additionally, because the results are strong, they have good access to bank debt, and certainly the private equity industry, if they're given opportunities to participate, are anxious to do so in these companies. Next slide. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'd like to discuss here really three elements that I see as key over the next several years for surgery centers to be able to grow and thrive. The first one I'll discuss here is efficiency. And the major cost elements on a profit and loss statement for a surgery center are first and foremost the labor costs of the center. And the best way to keep your labor costs low are to compress or consolidate your surgical schedule. Within a given day's activity at a surgery center, much of the staffing cost is fixed. So if you're doing surgery in that day, your staffing cost is fairly similar if you're doing 10 cases or if you're doing 40 cases. And that difference, if you can be doing the much higher numbers of cases in a given day that you're open, enables you to lower your labor cost per case dramatically, thereby increasing your profits per case. Other important efficiency elements are the physician preferences when it comes to choosing their surgical supplies on their case, on their cases. That's why having majority physician ownership, in our view, is so critical. When they are majority owners, they see the surgery center as their surgery center, which it is, and as a result, they tend to do things in the surgery center in a way that is, might be similar to what they do in their offices in terms of controlling costs and really focusing on efficiency. We have found, as we, in the past few years, we've been making many acquisitions of what I would call troubled surgery centers. These are surgery centers that are either not making money or are actually losing money. And what we have found in these situations, as we buy into these centers and work with the physician groups to turn them around, is that physicians faced with either writing checks to their surgery center or making some changes to schedule and other what we would see as normal efficiency gains that they are able to influence, they are able to make these very important decisions, motivated not in small part by the financial pressure that they are experiencing. Next slide. So having discussed really the efficiency and cost end of things, I'd like to turn my attention to the revenue end of things. And payer contracting today is something that we are putting enormous resources into on behalf of our individual surgery centers. And many surgery centers, when they first open, request contracts of the significant payers in their area, and feeling the pressure in the startup business, they just sign the contracts that they are offered. They want to get busy, they want to get the cases moving through the center. Unfortunately, this pattern of getting contracted immediately with really limited negotiation over the long term puts the surgery centers in a very difficult position and causes them to struggle financially. Really, what is important for a surgery center to be able to negotiate strong contracts is for the physicians to control where they take their surgical cases. If in the case of a new center, surgeons can say, look, once we have a good contract with, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, we will then move those cases from the hospital environment to the surgery center environment. If the physicians don't have the ability to move those cases and decide where they are done, then they have very limited pull or leverage with the payer. Being in a, when a case is done in the hospital environment, it is typically costing the payer a multiple of what it costs in the surgery center environment. And really, when you're contracting, you're really saying, look, you know, we're not asking to be paid as much as the hospital. We're happy to deliver savings and see that as part of our mission. But in order for us to bring those cases to the surgery center, the payer needs to pay adequately, not only cover the cost of the procedure, but also to provide sufficient margin for the center to be able to thrive and grow. In some cases, we have found, and I think SCA spoke to this, as well as I think we can look to the example of United Surgical Partners in our industry, that hospital partnerships can frequently make an enormous difference when it comes to negotiating a better contract with a payer. In the scheme of things, surgery centers are very small players in the insurance world, and by partnering with the hospital system, you really have a chance to be heard at the payer, whereas negotiating alone, it can be quite difficult. Next slide. I'd like to speak to physician recruitment. Others have spoken before me and I think share my view that there are dwindling numbers of available physicians to invest. Many are becoming employed by the hospital. Others may be in other surgery centers already that have restrictive covenants that prohibit them from investing in another surgery center. These trends together have led to a situation where, it's very much like the game that many of us played as children, which is musical chairs, where you look around and there are fewer opportunities and each of the centers is trying to, in essence, find or bring in the last available surgeons in a given market. Next slide. I'd like to just conclude my remarks by speaking again to the minority model. And minority, what I'm speaking of is that the corporate partner is in a minority position vis-a-vis the physicians. We find that the physicians do best and the centers are most successful when the physicians are in the majority. This is because as they own more, they not only have more skin in the game, but they also benefit to a greater extent from the profits of the surgery center. I once heard one of my competitors describe physician ownership like a frequent flyer program for surgeons. You know, every time they do a case, they get a little benefit. In a minority model, it doesn't have to be of such a small benefit to the physicians. I would say in our centers, the typical physician is augmenting their annual income by probably 15% to 20% on average. And at that level, it goes beyond a frequent surgeon program and has evolved into something that's important for not the surgeon and their family's well-being. When you have that kind of commitment, they're able to make the hard decisions in terms of controlling costs and schedule to enable the surgery centers to be efficient. Those in our industry who cling to a majority model, and there are still a number of them out there, really they're going to be handicapped in competing with those that are willing to allow the physicians to own a majority. corporate partners, I do believe continue to deliver value and expertise, and I think that their participation in the industry will continue to grow. And you know, if you look through the years, you don't see many minority players really lacking for capital. Instead, you see very happy minority model investors. And in contrast, the majority model, you see many of these investments where the capital providers have over time grown impatient to realize the type of returns that they've been hoping for. That's the end of my comments. I welcome any questions that people might have.
Right. Well, let me take just a few moments to thank our presenters. I think one of the things you're seeing in sort of the clear analysis and systems analysis that people like Andrew Hayek bring to this, and the leadership in the coalition, and the very clear view of the industry and the trends and how to approach things that you see from Brent and Luke Lambert are what I sort of see as the next level of leadership, the next generation of leadership in the business, some of the smartest people applying some of the most clear and concise strategic analysis to how to sort of make this business excel over the next decade. I know Andrew's done a remarkable job in transforming surgical care affiliates over the last 2 years and taking a leadership spot in the industry. Brent and Luke are two of the smartest people that I know and have done a tremendous job of both not just having a strategic plan, but executing on it as well. For David Fleisch, who gave an overview, the cornerstone of the Bain theory of consulting is this concept of profiting from the core and understanding what either a surgery center or hospital is really good at and where the profits come from, and then building a business first and foremost around that core. I know that Bain has a book on the subject called Profit from the Core, and for people that have an interest in buying that book, you can get it, you know, at the bookstores and on Amazon, or email David Fleisch, and I think he could probably link you to who can help you buy it. But it's just a remarkable, thoughtful book on some of the core concepts for developing a strategic plan and strategy. To wrap up, I think we're already at 12:30. If anybody has a question they'd like to ask, please email it to us quickly. And if not, I'll make one or two other very quick plugs while I wait to see if anybody asks any questions. First, we've got our Orthopedic Spine and Pain Management-Driven ASC Conference coming up June 10th to June 12th, at which each Andrew Hayek as well as Brent and Luke Lambert are giving different presentations. We've also got a couple of congressmen speaking and a number of speakers on topics on improving profitability for ASCs at that conference. If you register by the end of this week, we'll still extend the early registration discounts. Second is we're always looking for great speakers, both industry leaders, but just as importantly, physician and administrative leaders for webinars and topics for our October conference, as well as for webinars. And please feel free to email me with any thoughts or ideas you have, and would love to hear those. I think with that, there's one question for Andrew, which is under the changing method of looking at minority investments. If SCA is in a minority position, who then is in the controlling position? Is that the hospital, or is that the physicians, or who is the controlling party in these joint ventures, Andrew?
Sure, Scott. It depends. In a deal where we have a hospital partner and we're seeking to capture their managed care rates, it is almost always the case that the health system or hospital needs to be in the control position. Now, that does not require 51% ownership by the hospital. We'll often structure the deal such that the hospital and us together own 51%, and then there's an upstream legal entity that the hospital owns 51% of as well. So effectively, the physician still would own 49% of that entity, where there's a hospital partner and we're seeking to capture their managed care rates. Where we just have a partnership between us and physicians, we have situations where we own 20% or 30%, and the physicians own all of the remainder, again, when there is not a hospital partner. It's all very deal specific. And I'll lastly conclude with, in some cases, we'll initially buy 20 or 30%, then agree that 5 years later, after we've unlocked value in the center, we will, at a predetermined multiple, buy another 20 or 30% from the physicians if they're seeking additional liquidity down the road, again, after we've captured and created some value in the center through things like supply chain, like payer contracting, and other things. Is that responsive, Scott?
I think that's terrific and right on point. I would encourage, I know that each of these companies are exceptional companies. Andrew and his group, particularly looking at health system partnerships and helping health systems maximize an ASC strategy. Brent and Luke, looking at traditionally a physician ownership strategy where their company owns 30%, physicians own 70%. They've been extremely adept at figuring out how to turn around centers. I'd urge people, if you have an interest, to contact either one of the companies. And if you don't have their contact information, we can give it to you, but you should have it on the slides, on the early slides. David Fleisch, I appreciate your insight. I just find the stuff you guys have done is remarkable. And Brent and Luke and Andrew and Mark, thank you folks very much for joining us today. We'll talk to you guys shortly. And that'll wrap us up for today. Thanks.